Okay. Well, good morning. For those who are here for a first time, let me just say a little bit by way of introduction that'll also serve as introduction for the tape. I'm Roger Field. I am trained in American intellectual history and am excited about using that as a way of understanding the intellectual content or the thought patterns and value systems of the common mind among modern Americans, wanting to understand it better, not in its own right, but for the sake of the intersections between that common mind and the message of the gospel. So in a sense, we're using American intellectual history as a tool of analysis. I cited one day that definition of American intellectual history that says it's studying the present in terms of the past, and that's the kind of approach we're taking. That we're studying selected ideas, there's no way to come at the whole range, selecting them on the basis that they still have potence for the American mind and particular significance for the work of and the message of the gospel. In those first sessions, we looked briefly at what I called the European connection, the whole push-pull and love-hate tendency of Americans as to whether or not we are transplanted Europeans or whether we are something new, and that the fact that we call it the New World suggests how much we've opted for the latter. Talked about the frontier thesis and the abundance of land, the idea that what the fact that there was a frontier for almost 300 years of American history had an enormous effect upon the development of the nation, of its mind, of its thoughts, and its values. And then the last session, we talked about a cluster of Puritan ideas, not by any means the whole of Puritan thought, but a cluster of ideas that we tried to track in terms of the electness turning into the eliteness, the idea that God blesses and that this was to be a promised land for a new Israel with an errand in the wilderness, to borrow one of the book titles. Today, I want to take us into a different cluster. The title will be The Commitment to Independence and the Quest for Community. As we approach it, let's do that in prayer. Father, as individuals who must grapple with who we are individually and alone, we ask your help, you as a source of identity and you as a guide to understanding who each of us are. As a people gathered together, with a corporateness about us, we ask you to help us understand both what it is that you intend for us as a community and what it is that stands between us and the achievement of real community. So we ask your presence and your blessing. Amen. The material for today and tomorrow runs together more than the titles will suggest. Sometimes you get forced to assign titles and that covers the fact that it's really more of a flow. The two topics, today and tomorrow, are really four interrelated strands of American thought. The first is the individualism and the passion for independence that became a part of the mentality of this nation of ours. Second is the search for community, and I coupled those two because they have in common that there is a heavy kind of personality and relationship dimension to those two, sometimes companionate, sometimes contradictory or conflicting pieces of American mind. Then tomorrow we'll talk about the myth of the self-made man and the progressive vision that came to dominate for a time in this country. And I put those together because they have in common a heavy economic and institutional dimension to them. But in working with it, it was clear that I could just as well have rearranged them in any combination and that each combination has some problems with it. But I've grouped them so that today we talk about the commitment to independence and the quest for community. Tomorrow, about the myth of the self-made man and the progressive vision. And in another sense, you can take all four and coalesce them really into one major topic for the 2 days. And that is the way we commute between individualism and community in our thinking and doing, or if commute is too sanguine a term, the topic is the tensions between our needs for individualism and our needs for community, between our sense of separateness and our sense of commonness in living. Let me start by talking something of the roots of American individualism. Let's grant, first of all, the most common parts of the heritage of individualism, the parts that likely can be ascribed to anybody born and raised anywhere at any time in the history of the human race. For example, there is the natural curiosity about self and about others. There is the attempt by any person in any age to understand one's own situation, to think one's own thoughts and try to figure out why you think those thoughts, to make one's own way in life and to wonder why things get in the way or why persons or institutions or traditions stand in the way. There is a natural curiosity about self and about others, though it is surprising as you read the long sweep of history to find out that sometimes that was a more important need than others, that there were times when people tended to think in terms of curiosity about self, and other times when that was the exception and people tended to think in terms of common categories. Or another of the common parts of the heritage is that ruptured relationship with the Creator. That is the case for all human beings, not only those who know the Creator or know of him, but those who just simply by living are in fact participating in what the church has come to call the fall. And one of the evidences of that brokenness or fall is the anxious preoccupation with self that goes well beyond curiosity and that really represents kind of a dire anxiety about whether one is what one ought to be. Or another piece of the common heritage, at least since the Italian Renaissance, is the recovery of identity questions. Who am I? What kind of person am I? As different from the kind of fixed categories of medieval Europe that tended to tell people what they are or were and then expected them to accept that and penalize them if they questioned it. It is a relatively recent phenomenon, that is to say from maybe the 14th century on, that identity questions came to be first allowed and then seen to be in some way intellectually stimulating and maybe pleasing to the Creator, if people cared what the Creator thought, or certainly of the stuff of which living was made, to ask questions about who am I, why am I here, what am I supposed to do. That's a fairly recent surge in the Western mind, recent if you can count from 14th century on as recent. And with that, there tended to be a greater emphasis on satisfactions in this life rather than enduring for the hope of the life to come. That's one of the kind of shifts that happened in the development of what has tended to be called the modern mind. A greater desire to see satisfaction and goodness and fulfillment in this life. Now, having kind of granted those common parts of the heritage, let's start talking about the things that are peculiar or special mindsets for the American mind, starting with something about the mindsets of American immigrants. People came to this new world for a variety of reasons. They came to escape religious persecution, or they came to find better economic opportunity than they had in the old country, or they came to escape constrictive social settings, or sometimes literally to escape prisons. Sometimes they came simply because they were just plain restless and aggressive. If you cut that another way, in terms of individual versus community impulses, some of those who came as communities. You can name some of them yourselves. Certainly the Plymouth Colony, certainly some of the Quaker communities in Pennsylvania, certainly one at least of the major Lutheran groups, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, came as community. And there are lots of others that tend to have retained identity in smaller communities. Some came alone but came to join communities. Any number of the Puritans who came in the first generation after the founding of Massachusetts Bay came alone but came expecting to join a community of like-minded people and came in order to join that. Others came, and sometimes it was the same people, came to find freedom. They really were not so much looking for community as they were looking for a way to get out of the constrictions of the communities that had held them in some sense hostage. Some came to find solitude, and some came simply to find themselves, though that language was not fashionable yet then. And all they knew was that there was a kind of a restlessness and a dissatisfaction with where they were and what they were doing before they came. Even with that variety, you can sketch some characteristics of all of them, even of the most community-minded of them. You can sketch some characteristics that predisposed them toward individualism, or at least that made them think they were able to dispense with community if necessary. They were not dependent on community. They didn't have to be. They were, for example, people with a willingness to take large risks. There is a risk factor in the immigrant generation. It shows up as recently as the Southeast Asians and the Cubans, particularly the Southeast Asians, who have been coming to this country in the last few years. To emigrate is to take a large risk. And these were risk-taking people. If they sometimes held on tightly to certain of their old world traditions, it was because they had so totally let go of some other things. And having taken such large risks in terms of geography and sometimes of economic style of making a living, they did sometimes hang on to other things to compensate. But they were willing to take large risks. They were willing to leave extended family behind. That's no small thing. Those who decided to leave made a decision about their need of family or lack of need, particularly those who came alone. And a lot of them did come alone as single young adults. That really takes a lot of internal independence, or at least the belief that one can exist alone, to leave that extended family behind. And they came, many of them, willing to start over. And that's no small thing. Many of them came in midlife. And if you've heard some of the stories of immigrants who came in midlife, having either sold what they had at home or having had nothing much at home to sell, they came, took on a new country, eventually a new language for many of them, a new economic style, a new political style, if they had political interests at all, a new value system, had to get hold of that, and it must have been like an octopus at first trying to get hold of all the pieces of that. They were willing to start over in midlife, and that's a rather large willingness. In other words, they really had in common a very independent mindset, even among those who came in with or for a community. You witness, for example, in the illustration from the other day about the Puritans, you witness how many New Englanders refused to fake the circumstances of a spiritual conversion. And it not to have been too hard to fake, because the clergy rehearsed that whole 10-stage business about how you ought to go from being a frankly lost sinner to discovering that you had been elected. It ought to have been easy to fake if you wanted to. And it is a mark of the independence that they weren't willing to be coerced into that, even though by not having that conversion experience and therefore becoming full members of the church, they couldn't vote, they couldn't hold office, and they were looked upon as less than the best citizens of the community. You could say that the compensation was they didn't have to go to church, except that by law they had to go to church. So they gained nothing by staying out. But their sense of independence said, if I ain't had the experience, I ain't going to do it. There was that sense about them. Or, to use another illustration, simply note how unsettled the settlers were. Many of them really did come saying to themselves, I want to find a piece of land and live on it the rest of my life and there be buried. But most of them ended up living on more than one piece of land and moving voluntarily, lured by new land or pushed by a kind of restlessness. The settlers really didn't settle all that much. It would be fun to share some illustrations from my own family, and I may do some of that later on. Let me try to track that individualism or independence thing. Let's talk about the evolution of independence as a priority for the nation. We've already talked about how they gradually thought themselves to be farther and farther away from Europe, how they came to think of themselves not as transplanted Europeans, but as Americans. And we talked also about the tendency of the frontier to attract and reward the independent person. But let's take another step along that line. By 1776, the American experiment was 167 years old in terms of continuous settlement. When we celebrated the bicentennial just a few years ago, I was aware again how we have tended to telescope the pre-revolutionary time and think of it as not very long, and then elongate the time of the nation and make it seem very long. The truth is we have almost as much pre-revolutionary war history as post-revolutionary. And that means that by 1776, most of the 4 million plus Americans were native born. This was their only home. They didn't think of themselves, those who had been born here, as transplanted Europeans. They thought of themselves as being Americans and probably had the same irritation toward the immigrant generation that Will Herberg says most every second generation has toward the immigrant one. You know, his classical phrase, third generation's trying to remember what the second generation tried to forget. That whole business about the sequencing of where one calls home. At some point, probably in the 1740s, at least the historians I read pick the 1740s as watershed time, probably around 1740, most colonists ceased to think of themselves as colonists and resented being treated as English subjects. Now, if you read the propaganda of the committees of correspondence that led up to the actual outbreak of the Revolutionary War, it would appear to you that the English government was badly misusing the colonies. There were some cases of English misuse, but by and large, what the English government tried to do was treat the colonists the way they treated all English citizens. They weren't taxing them more. They weren't subjecting them to less home rule, a whole range of those sort of things. The issue was not taxation without representation precisely, though there is some of that, and it was not abuses in trade, though there was some of that. The issue was primarily that Americans felt they ought not to be governed by Englishmen, and the English felt they were still governing Englishmen. It's that kind of flavor. From that time on, the desire for independence was clear, but until the external threats could be removed, there was not much likelihood of it developing. The colonists were not really prepared to throw off English protection as long as French and their Indian allies lay at all of the western border, which at that time meant west of the Appalachians. But with the successful conclusion of the French and Indian Wars in 1763 or thereabout, the stage really was set for a declaration of independence, and the problem was simply to build a case that would be persuasive enough so that those colonists who had a habit of letting things stand the way they were could be aroused, inspired, turned on fire for this new cause. It helps then to take a look at the American Revolution both from a radical perspective and then from a conservative one, or to sequence it that way. In the frame of years from about 1772 to 1789, that's 17 years, that's not a very long time, in the range of those 17 years, we went through four kinds of phases, if you will, of this whole tension between individualism or independence on the one hand and community or coercion on the other. We started by exercising our individualism in terms of the refusal to pay certain taxes and that sort of thing. Exercised our individualism. We won our independence. We discovered the limits of that independence in the years under the Articles of Confederation, and we fashioned an instrument to force community. That's kind of a preview. Now let me do that more carefully. Those 17 years are a time of great creativity and experimentation, especially when you think about how few they were and how scattered a people they were. I subscribe to that theory that says people do rise to the times. It's not just an accident. There were a lot of people who rose to the times, who sensed that it was a very creative, a fluid time when a new norm could be set. And out of that ferment comes the Declaration of Independence, which was, for its time, a radically enlightened document by people who had become powerfully secularized and who had developed a dream that had nothing to do with the old world. I say powerfully secularized because, in spite of the references to Creator, we are dealing primarily with deists who had incorporated a kind of a watered-down version of colonial religion into what later gets labeled as civil religion. Not necessarily a lack of belief in God, but certainly not a passionate belief in God either, and rather frankly, a rejection of what we would call Christology, any terribly serious grappling with the idea of Christ as Lord and Savior. The Declaration was that radical document, and it worked, it came out of an exceptional optimism about a combination that they believed existed on American soil and existed nowhere else. That was the combination of an uncorrupted environment and basic, that is to say, unsquelched or unpressed down human nature. There's really some optimism about human nature here, a belief that people are not really born evil. And if you can imagine Puritan descendants saying this, but they do. They're not really born evil. What they're born is kind of unprogrammed. And in the old world, their spirits were pressed down and their opportunities were cut short and they were spiritually deprived. But in this new world, that basically good human nature in an uncorrupted environment, that would lead to a wholly new thing. You probably know that the Revolutionary War itself severely strained this optimism, that they had trouble keeping volunteers. If you read the story of the attempts to maintain an army, especially of the Valley Forge year, winter and that sort of thing, trouble maintaining volunteers, trouble funding the war effort, trouble with all the Tories among the colonists who believed that it was to their own best interests that England win, trouble disciplining themselves for a common end, and that in the light of their common belief that, as Benjamin Franklin put it, if we don't all hang together, we shall hang separately. Even under the direst of circumstances, they had trouble maintaining cohesion, and their sense of the nobility of independence was already strained by the time the war ended. But in the 6 years in the aftermath of that, from roughly 1781 to 87, they discovered that they had reached too far. A logical extension of their belief in independence and the lack of external coercion and the right of individuals to develop themselves unhindered, the logical extension of that was a kind of a loose federation of the 13 colonies, the so-called Articles of Confederation, a Congress with relatively little power to act but only to recommend to the states, a belief that revenues could be raised by voluntary subscriptions in the states, a belief that you did not need to maintain an army but a citizen army could always be drawn together in case of emergency. What happened for them was that they discovered they had reached too far, that they had enfranchised independence at the cost of cohesion and common good, that they had a government without authority, that they had no power to collect taxes and therefore no power to pay debts. They weren't even able to pay the veterans. You know that they paid the soldiers very little, if anything, during the time, instead promising that if they won, the soldiers would be given free land as payment. And they were. They were all given title to lands, not always to specific acreages, but rather a kind of a certificate that said you are entitled to, and then you have to apply for it through government. They were not even able to fund those. There was debasement of the currency. There was speculation in land. Just to illustrate this, very early on after the war, when veterans discovered that their land certificates would not immediately get them onto land or that they couldn't find the capital to develop the land, speculators, American speculators, started buying them up. And guess where they marketed them? Back in England. London had a regular bit of its stock exchange for the exchange of certificates for American frontier land. Individualism run wild was the experience of the years immediately after the war. It has been part of our popular mythology that when the patriots of the Declaration of Independence and the Fighting of the War fame saw that the experiment was not working, this same group gathered, granting that a few may have died and a few new would have to come in, that this same group gathered and fashioned a stronger instrument, the United States Constitution, and a stronger government, a union of states. That simply is not the case. The signatures alone suggest that only six of those who were involved in drafting the Declaration of Independence were also involved in drafting the United States Constitution. In fact, it was a very different group that gathered out of the chaos of those 6 years under the Articles, who gathered appointed by legislatures, not elected in any common sense, but then, of course, neither were the signers of the Declaration of Independence elected in a common sense. They gathered to rescue the experiment, to save independence from its own excesses. They gathered to develop an instrument of strong central government with a bias toward economic matters. If that runs in the face of the kind of history that you learned and have thought, I just want to commend to you an old book that is still better than anything new around. Charles Beard, historian, the book is called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. He says it's coincidence that it was published in 1913, at the time when this country was debating the adoption of a graduated income tax. If it was a coincidence, it certainly was a happy one. Because what the book does is to say, it does simply a survey of the birth, vocation, wealth, and particular advantages that the drafters of the American Constitution would have out of its adoption. And it's just a fascinating kind of thing. I guess it's still in print. I was able to buy one rather recently. I commend it to you. Charles Beard, American historian, a very famous historian. What happened was that they gathered to rescue the experiment from its excesses. They convened to conserve the independence by way of a strong government. They were pro-property and pro-economic development. They favored tariffs. They favored a strong national currency, fully funded on gold and silver. They favored the strict honoring of all outstanding war debts at dollar-for-dollar value. And it's not just coincidence that a lot of them held a great deal of that paper, some of which they had bought dollar for dollar, much of it of which, though, they bought later at very much depreciated value and stood to gain a great deal. They were anti-libertarian. Now, let me try another piece of the myths that we live with. One of our myths is that the greatness of the American... No, start over. One of our beliefs is that the greatness of the American Constitution rests heavily on the Bill of Rights, and I think that's accurate. One of the myths is that the Bill of Rights was also drafted by the drafters of the Constitution and that it was a part of their value system, and that simply is not true. Bill of Rights was not part of what was submitted to state ratifying conventions. The drafters of the Constitution were not interested in that Bill of Rights. When they were pressed on it, they said, after all, that's a state matter. Let the states have their bills of rights, and many of the states did. What happened was that and I must say one other thing. The drafters of the Constitution also did not believe that they wanted to submit the Constitution to state legislatures for approval, because legislatures, especially those that were bicameral, that had two houses, were likely to have a lower house that had too many common people in it, and they were afraid of what would happen. So it was they submitted the Constitution, and with it the ratification plan was that special conventions ought to be convened in each state, and that the conventions would ratify on behalf of the states. And only those who owned property could vote for those who would sit in the ratifying conventions. Now, that's just plain history, and it's important because it helps us get at the tensions between individualism and the coercive community. The result of the Constitution was a relatively strong government. By the way, I believe that these landed and vested interests were absolutely right. The Articles of Confederation couldn't work. The nation was going to be picked to pieces, and it was the right thing to do. But it's just important that we be clearer about who they were and what their vested interests were. The result of the Constitution was a relatively strong central government, one nation, not a collection of states. Its community requirements were much greater than had been the case under the Articles of Confederation. But its community requirements were much less than the community requirements today. They were initially quite limited, but by their standards quite strong. There were requirements for a common economy with a bias toward property and business, in the belief that that was for the common good. There were requirements for common defense and common foreign policy. There was a Bill of Rights, even though the states forced the addition of it before they would ratify. At least it was added, so it was part of the document from the beginning almost. A healthy respect for individual liberties and initiatives, and it made for a remarkably fluid society that had enough cohesion to stay together and enough flexibility so that people could maximize their opportunities. What seems to have happened is that individualism survived as a strong American priority, but not as an unlimited one. Now, if you turn that over and ask about that other strain, namely, what was our experience with the development of community, then we'll have the two kind of running in common tracks. A few words about the history of our search as a nation for community. We've already said that colonial America had more diverse and sometimes mutually exclusive subcommunities than most nations have ever had to deal with. Already in the first 13 colonies, you have such variety of background and such former enemies having now to deal with each other as allies that the nation already had to grapple with community issues early on. That there was also this sense that community in this new world was to be voluntary. It was to be established over against the common enemy. And when there was sufficient anger with the common enemy, then there was community of a sort before and during the waging of the revolution. But it was quickly their discovery that the voluntary community was not effective in normal times. That what worked under duress, and then only worked somewhat, didn't work well at all when the crisis was over. What they discovered was that the need to maintain independence and opportunity were important enough to require that some of the independence be curbed, that there be a voluntary surrender of sovereignty precisely for the sake of securing and keeping a good and healthy kind of independence. Therefore, what happened for Americans was that independence and cooperation, or individualism and community, were in the popular mind neither natural enemies nor natural partners. They were somewhat uneasy in their alliance. There was a tension. They were never satisfied with the balance between liberty and limits. And there was always the kind of pushing and pulling between those who wanted more limits and those who wanted more liberty, with power politics as the means of shifting the balance. Let me then just illustrate how that idea cropped up from time to time in the years after that. The first major cropping up of that old debate between liberty and limits was when the Western farmers, and again, Western wasn't very far west, it meant the other side of the Appalachians from the eastern seaboard, when the Western farmers of Kentucky and Tennessee and to some extent Ohio and Western Pennsylvania, when the Western farmers found community because they perceived a common enemy, and the common enemy was the Eastern banking and credit establishment, the urban East with its strong economic control over credit and marketing. Andrew Jackson becomes the hero of that group, and his election, his non-election the first time around when it was thrown into the House of Representatives, and then his election the second time around when they felt doubly cheated. Not only are they cheated by the bankers and the Eastern interests, but in an election where Jackson had the majority vote, No, not the majority. Where he had more votes than either of the other two candidates, he was cheated out of the presidency by the House of Representatives. So they come back, roaring back 4 years later. He is elected, and this time they have community around this sense that their interests are different than the interests of the Eastern Seaboard. Later, you know, that takes on a different shape. It becomes formally the argument of states' rights versus national policy or national solidarity. And the issues that lead up to the Civil War are considerably more complex than simply those who wanted slaves versus those who believed slavery was wrong. They have to do with that whole business about how much right does the total community have to impose its will on subparts of the community, and the state's right mindset said, this nation is trying to hold too much. We need more room for individualism and for subgroup decision making. Still later, probably from, let's say, 1875 to 1895 or 98, somewhere in that range, it shows up as another round of Westerners, only now these really are Westerners. This is at least west of the Mississippi. It's mostly west of the Missouri. And that's agrarian unrest again. It took on a different name this time. They came to call themselves populists. But their understanding was that they were being held down not only by banking and credit interests, though that's certainly there in William Jennings Bryan's emphases and so forth, but also that they were being threatened by Catholics, by cities, by industrial workers, by that whole shift of population and emphasis from an emphasis on the farmer and the land to an emphasis on the worker and the product and commerce. And there is a commonality about the agrarian unrest of the last third of the 19th century. Interestingly enough, they did not perceive of themselves as a laboring group, and so have never been, never to this day, have been able to find common ground with industrial workers. And most American farmers have been, and still are, anti-union in their thinking. Their own farm organizations come at very much loggerheads with each other, particularly if there's any talk about a common holding action or a common marketing process, or particularly if there's any talk of violence at all. The agrarian unrest and the populism was another case of community, but not of the whole national community, but of a community that sensed a conspiracy by another community. That conspiracy business in American thought, the kind that allowed for the McCarthy era as recently as the 1950s and the Senator Nye munitions investigation in the 1930s, that conspiracy mentality has always allowed the development of sub-communities, but has tended to work against the commonality of the whole nation. Then there was also, spanning some of this same time, the passion for what Oscar Handlin and others have called the melting pot, the idea that the way to deal with immigrants and their values is to melt them all down, and then when they crystallize out again, they'll crystallize out as good typical Americans, and that's what they ought to be. The pressures to make everybody homogeneous testify more to anxiety than to community. It was not because we coveted each other's friendship so much as it was because we feared that the value systems, particularly when the immigrants started to come from the Mediterranean ring, where it was feared that their allegiance to the Pope was greater than any political allegiance they might develop, and when they came from Eastern Europe, where already there was terrible fear of Marxists and anarchists and that whole kind of mentality. And then one other illustration from later years, and that's the New Deal. There is in the American experience with Franklin Roosevelt and at least the first two terms, there is a shift toward a community of responsibility that is a relatively new phenomenon in American thought. There are a couple of earlier pieces. The adoption of the graduated income tax was, in fact, a method of redistributing wealth, though a very modest one. But it was never billed that way. It was billed as funding the government. It was It was graduated on the basis that some could afford to pay more. It was not really graduated. It was not sold on the idea that you could take from the rich and give to the poor. And in fact, until the New Deal, there was very little taking from the rich and even less giving to the poor. The New Deal does represent a shift toward a community of responsibility and does represent a kind of a suggestion that individualism has lost some of its power. And now, with the latest election, we have a return to that earlier ethos of self-reliance, less social engineering, less taking from those who earn and giving to those who don't. It is a repristination, a recovery of an old balance, a move back to an old balance, as old at least as, say, the years before World War I, when you would license individualism and independence and initiative and then expect that in the long run the nation would be better served by that than by limiting those who are strong for the sake of those who are weak. Let me suggest finally about seven intersections with the gospel, and I just lay them out as starters for what I hope will be discussion. One, it is clearly the Father's intention that his creation live in harmony and commonality. You cannot walk through the Genesis material or any of the gathering of the people that became Israel, or you can't walk past John 17 without some clear, ringing sense that God expected that we live together and in commonality, that when he said it is not good that a man should be alone, that's far more than a sexual statement. That's a statement about our being made for community. And secondly, then, that any elevation of self, which is at the expense of others, is the result of our brokenness and is sin. There simply is no way to say that the rampant individualism of the 19th century in America could be right. Three, it takes more effort, but the case can also be built from Scripture that the affirmation and the development of the self is part of God's intention, that he does want us to experience positive selfhood and not simply to be submerged in a community or not simply told by a community who we are and what we are to do. So that what happens, if I can take it as a fourth step, what happens is that authentic self needs and authentic group needs are both valid. And if they are rightly understood, they ought not to be in conflict. It ought to be possible for one to develop oneself and also to develop one's place in a community. That identity ought to come both from self-development and from community sources, and that identity ought to have dimensions that are complementary and that make for richness of life. Then, fifth, what happens is that the American experience wrongly understands both the purpose of the individual and the purpose of the community. It wrongly understands, not totally, obviously, but sufficiently so that there are major problems. Those who are lured into rugged individualism are often not able to relate very well, or are able to relate only with the like-minded, or seek to relate by dominating. Now let me just flick off then some witnessing, some kind of thought starters. Think, for example, of the terrible proliferation of denominations in this country. The individualism that has allowed every self-styled prophet to become so sure of himself as to declare that others were wrong, and then to gather, and often to pay pious homage to the idea that Jesus wants his church to be one, and then blithely start another church. That's the piece of individualism. Or the split out of fundamentalist versus liberal. Enormous the energy that has gone into the infighting between two major camps, and how they have infought even when at times, as on Prohibition, their agendas coincided. But they still fought each other on everything else. Or if you remember that book from the mid-50s, Vance Packard's Status Seekers, that whole business about individualism as it shows up in what he calls the long road from Pentecostal to Episcopal. He starts out by saying, isn't it curious, you know, that if religions really are speaking the truth and it's the revealed will of God and they read the same Bible, how is it that most of the poor people end up Pentecostals and most of the rich ones find their way into Episcopal churches? Doesn't that say something? Or one that has been very formative for me is the reaction of a group of clergy to the movie Easy Rider. I just simply give you the illustration because it has stuck with me. Easy Rider comes from, I would guess, 1970 or 71. Is that about right?
69.
Okay, well, right in that range. And I happened to be on a bishop's staff at the time, and we had a habit of drawing together the pastors who had been out of the seminary less than a year, they and their spouses, for about a three-day retreat. We thought of it as a good time to do some community building, to help do some group processing of problem areas, things like that. We'd had some pretty heavy sessions, good sessions, there in Lincoln, Nebraska, on that subject, and as I recall it, we had about 15 pastors and their spouses. So Bishop Madsen said, why don't we, for something different tonight, instead of sitting down for another long talk session, let's go to a movie, and then we'll come back and talk about the movie. And we picked Easy Rider as the movie to go to. If you didn't see the movie, of course, there's going to be a problem with the telling, but the punchline may serve for you. We came back to the hotel afterward and had lined up refreshments, and we're sitting in a circle like this, and Archie Benson sat back and said, well, what do you think of the movie? One of the pastors, now this is, somebody had graduated from seminary just 8 months before. One of the pastors got really just beet red, leaned forward in his chair, and he says, I think anybody who swims nude and smokes pot deserves to get shot. Now, that's there. My only reluctance about Easy Rider is I wish they had not put it in the South. I wish we'd quit putting all the redneck stuff in the South, because the rest of us then kind of write it off by saying the trouble with them is they're Southerners. I really wish they'd found a way to put that in the plains of Kansas or something like that.
Southern California.
Southern California? All right. That's just an illustration of the kind of coerciveness, you know? Obviously, what the seminary tried to teach during those 4 years did not take very well. And that's not a statement about the seminary. What it means is you can be so vaccinated with the American commitment to independence and coercion that you can't hear what the gospel has to say. And then one final illustration, and it's only suggestive. In the old Saturday Evening Post, there was a speaking out. It wasn't called speaking out. What was that? That page where a famous columnist, maybe it was called speaking out. No, it was a special editorial section. Marshall McLuhan wrote an article in there, roughly again about that same time, and maybe even a bit earlier, because it was in the heyday of the coffee houses. And McLuhan said, what is this thing? Particularly, what does it mean that coffee houses that are little holes in the wall are succeeding, but when the entrepreneurs got into the act and built the big ones with the fancy lights and the speakers and all that, they fell on their face? What does that mean? McLuhan answers it by saying the clue lies in who goes to the coffee houses. Who primarily goes to the coffee houses are the children of the middle class and the upper class, not of the poor. He said, my suspicion, and he labeled it as a suspicion, my suspicion is that they are the products of our version of the American dream, which was that every kid ought to have his own bed to sleep in and his own room and maybe his own bathroom and certainly his own clothes. We've put a lot of space around our kids on the assumption that that's a good thing. We have in fact done so much of that that they don't know how to touch each other or get close, except in the overt business of sexual encounter, and even there they don't know how to do it very well. He didn't say that. He said, my suspicion is that they are attracted to the coffee house because here is a place where it's legitimate to get wedged in body to body with other people and to have a common experience. Then in summary, what I'd be suggesting is that we have an excess of individualism, a kind of a passion for independence, which does terrible violence to our need for community, and that it is a part of the message of the gospel to try to work at redressing that balance. Okay, it's your turn. Go.
How would you relate free choice to direct you in either way? If one is excess and there's a minimal amount of the other, I don't know what that balance is, but where then does free choice come into play as to which you pick? Or is that another way of saying you're independent to pick either one?
Well, we predispose free choice in this society by suggesting to people that they ought always to choose for their own best interests. So that's the first kind of clue. The other thing is that we exaggerate how much freedom is possible for a human community to deal with. We simply think that that more freedom is possible. It was for me a kind of a neat time when you started to see a little wisps of long hair crawl out behind at the back of a hard hat helmet of a miner or a construction worker. Or I was struck by if you want to catch a bit of wistfulness, Lyndon Johnson, who felt he was driven from the White House by the student generation over the Vietnam War, in some of those rare pictures after he left the White House and moved back to Texas, he let his hair grow. Or of Richard Nixon, they said that he got terribly angry once at a photographer, one of the official photographers, because the photographer made the mistake of taking a picture of Nixon wearing lavender trousers and a kind of a very casual sport coat. And what he was saying, in effect, was if he dared, he'd like not to be as rigid as he had to be to fit the images. I don't know. I think we exaggerate our freedom. I think we think that the individual can achieve more satisfaction alone than is in fact possible. And that what we ought to be saying is that freedom of choice always ought to have a bias toward choosing for the needs of many. Frank?
Well, I think it's probably saying the same thing. The denial that we're created for community by that whole game that there is individualism, that we can make it alone. I mean, the hermits are just so few, and the pros are just so minute.
Yeah.
That instead of somehow celebrating the fact that we are people who are indeed created in the community, yeah, and can make, and then choices are within the community, not choice between individualism and community. Yeah. They don't exist.
That's right. By the way, Thoreau sent his laundry home once a week to his mother. Did you know that? He did. He did. And Jerome carpeted his cave. I'm not kidding. There was a hand here.
Just give us a clue. In our society, it's thought to be weak, and it's not a good thing to be dependent upon others.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, are there other societies where that is the reverse?
My reading of Margaret Mead is pretty stale by now, but my recollection is that when she goes at the primitive societies, she says that, in fact, they generally had a much higher premium on interdependence and a mutuality and a need for each other, an assignment of tasks that were considered vital even if there was hierarchy among them. So apparently we are exceptional in our failure to understand that.
Is that inclusive to Christian societies, though, this feeling of weakness if you depend on others? The primitive societies, I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
Are there any
Tomorrow, I will be citing, when we deal with the myth of the self-made man, how the church mostly just echoed what was being said in the society, that it was not prophetic at all in that regard, and therefore that when the society said independence is a good thing, the churches said the same thing, that the ideal became the strong person who didn't need anybody else. We have always had the ability to care for somebody who suffered a natural misfortune. We mistakenly call them acts of God, natural misfortune. But we've had a terrible time thinking that we had any obligation toward people whose lives somehow just didn't work out the way ours did.
I think the body of Christ is almost impossible in other individuals. And to understand, Paul,
yes,
that within the gathered community are all the essentials for the church and to be Christ's, yeah, presence. It's unreal.
And among the images, we have tended to choose the congregational one, which is, after all, the independent individual volunteering to join and keeping one foot on the doorstep in case you want to leave again. Congregationalism is the easiest model to take because it requires the least commitment. Body of Christ language is really tough to deal with. The language that I've heard us trying to get at, because dependency is not a good thing either. Volunteering to be dependent is not a good thing. We've been grappling with the word interdependent, and it's a super concept. The trouble is that the word itself is not terribly strong. You know, sometimes you need a word that's got some vigor to it, and that doesn't have as much vigor as it might have. But by whatever right language, interdependence, our need for each other to both give and receive from each other, has much more ground for community in it than the way we've normally come at it. Do you want to finish up?
There's a good word. Need for us.
Yeah. Yep.
Isn't a Christian almost schizophrenic today who is taught to be competitive,
yes,
and must be very competitive on the market, and then comes into the church and we say, no, it's all community. And
yes.
How can you live with it?
It's that's schizophrenic in the sense that it puts you in a bind, particularly if the church faithfully talks about community and encourages the development of community. On the other hand, if McLuhan is at all right, and I think he is, then there is another side of us that's yearning for community, and the church, especially the small church, has the option of giving what there is not much available anywhere else. Some of you know that I studied with George Forel at one time. Someone asked Forel once, when he was talking about some of these things, if you could change just one institutional process or piece in this society, what would you do? He said, I would change grade school, particularly kindergarten and first grade. He said, the way I would do it is I would put groups of children together and promise to grade the group but not the individuals. And I would make sure that I had some of the best students and the poorest students in the group. That catches a piece of it. I don't know, you know, it's no solution. It suggests that a community has to understand diversity of fortune, diversity of belief. It has to be a community that's given, not just negotiated. Lauren.
A recent author has been studying the question of human scale as to the flowering of a society. And I wonder if you've given any thought to what was going on in those 17 years when things seemed to come together so well and the nation was able to express itself in terms of the scale of the communities in which people lived in the geographic area at that time, mostly the Eastern Seaboard, that allowed them to play that out, and the problems we have today, this enormous scale, physically and compacting of people in cities and all the rest of that. Have you reflected much about that, the role of scale in the shaping of our mind?
Only at two points. The one is that it was certainly true of the Revolutionary War period and for a good generation after that, that most people were primarily self-sufficient. They did primarily raise their own food and made their own clothing, and what they produced for the consumption by others was relatively small amount. And therefore, their interdependence was not as great. Their dependence on others was not as great. But that doesn't get at the scale question. The other piece of it is, when does a society become impersonal? When does the scale get so big or the mobility get so vast that impersonality results? And we crossed that line terribly early. The largest city at the time of the Revolutionary War is New York, and it's about 20 to 25,000 people huddled on the lower end of Manhattan. Philadelphia, about 8,000, Boston, about 12, something like that. Even there, any of you who live in communities that size, even there, you've already gone beyond the willingness and methods of a community to know everybody who's in it. You've already gone beyond it. When you also have churches that are not inclusive, are not parishes, meaning they are responsible for the whole of geography, but are rather individualized, meaning they are responsible only for people who have volunteered to join, when you have that kind of mentality, then it is terribly possible to simply ignore the people you don't want to see. Michael Harrington's The Other Americans is that kind of illustration. Lauren, did you want to say more about scale than that?
Well, no, I was just comment that the height of the Greek civilization's highest cultural achievement, the average city was 5,000.
Yeah, yeah. If it were possible, the whole Newtown idea went at business of them, at the right size community, but it's clearly not possible. And when you look at the masses of people gathering around Mexico City, around Tokyo, around Rio de Janeiro, just a horrendous kind of thing. One more.
We're living in a highly mobile society, and the average individual moves once out of every 5 years.
Yeah.
And how do you get that sense of community when you're on the move and yeah. the society is encouraging that?
Yeah, let me preview tomorrow by saying we almost always pay a higher social price for progress than we think we will. And what happens is that we need to develop methods by which communities stay open and inviting, and individuals feel the immediate need to find and join a community. It's going to have to be both ways: open communities inviting, and people who know their need. Well, we must quit for today. See you tomorrow.